Welcome to Holden Village. Today is the 19th of August, 1995, and in the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Jeff Dwyer, and he will be doing a session entitled Resources and Support for Long-Term Care. So, let's listen in on Jeff. Today is really, as the title suggests, Information and Resources for Long-Term Care. Is really meant to provide us with an opportunity to have a rather open-ended discussion with some material that I would like to input into the discussion with respect to long-term care issues, questions that you might have. But specifically, we talked quite a bit yesterday, and perhaps we might want to revisit a couple of those things just for the people that weren't here. In terms of, I feel very strongly that focusing on issues of concern to older people and issues of concern to any person, regardless of age, as it might relate to older family members, even neighbors or people in the community, is something that Christian people and the church in particular perhaps could be doing a better job of, might choose to focus more of their energies on. Two other comments, just so you know where this fits. Well, this is sort of the fourth of four sessions we've done this week. If you haven't been to those previous sessions, we're going to repeat them again next week. And so while you work backwards a little bit, the first couple of sessions, I think most would agree, were a little more lecture oriented and information dense. But I think that we need to, from my perspective, those were important. I'm a professor at Wayne State University in Detroit, and also run an institute of gerontology there. So my perspective is largely as a researcher, but I think it's important for all of us to understand. In fact, you may recall that first session, there wasn't even a great deal of understanding about how many people there were in this country over the age of 65 now, what the demographic trends for the future, i.e. that population is going to double in the next 50 years, might mean for us. And those are the sorts of things that we'll talk about in the first couple of sessions when we start up again this coming week. And then yesterday, I just wrote this list on the board again, but this is a book that if you have ongoing interest in issues of aging and how aging, health, family, religion / spiritual issues tie together. Harold Koenig is, I spent some time in the spring since this is not a specific area that I spend a lot of my research in terms of religion and aging, I spent some time sort of casting about and seeing what was available, and it turns out that there is not a whole lot available out there that you and I might readily get our hands on. I've said a couple of times that I even went to three large Christian bookstores in the Detroit area, and while I could walk down rows of marriage and family books and rows of child books and rows of other kinds of books, the only books I could find that had aging in the title or were anything really about aging from a Christian perspective or from a church-based perspective were sort of devotional books that were targeted toward older people like they might be targeted to other groups. So I feel very strongly that this is an area of that we all need to be concerned about, but that in particular in the context of constrained economic resources, a lot of the discussion you've heard out of the Congress in the last couple of years have been along the lines of healthcare reform, and now more recently, specifically reform of Medicare and Medicaid, the two main health and long-term care programs that back up older people. And so I think there's a lot for us to think about and talk about. So yesterday, we started with Dr. Koenig's, he's an MD, he's also has a Master's of Divinity and has written a great deal on aging and religion over the last couple of decades, really. And this book, Aging and God, is one that if you're interested in a broad range of issues, it's probably 500 pages long, 20 or 22 chapters, but I found it to be a really useful resource.
What did you call your class yesterday so that I might take it in next week?
It is, yesterday it was Aging in the Church, Opportunities for Ministry.
Okay.
And in some ways today is really an extension of that, okay, because great. We had quite a long discussion and didn't get quite through all of the things that I had wanted to. The first session was called Aging in Family Relationships, and the second session was called Aging, and will be called Aging, Health and Social Justice. The social justice notion being, for those that were there, that when we talk about aging issues today, we're really talking about a set of issues that predominantly affect women and also have particularly harsh consequences for other people who are harmed in other segments of the population when there are constrained resources. So, for example, in the older population, the fastest growing groups are older people of color. And those are the same groups of people that are being impacted in many other walks of life, and perhaps we need to spend some time thinking about and focusing on. So yesterday, we used this list of Dr. Koenig's, let me move over just a little bit, on what he perceives to be the needs of elders. And I'd like to just quickly repeat the list because the discussion we had around them, I'll try and bring up a couple of the items, was quite interesting. And then what I'd like to do is talk more specifically, perhaps starting first with just asking you what in the churches that you attend or that you're aware of are going on with respect to ministry or a focus on older people in your churches. We noted yesterday that among the research that I was able to come across in preparing for these sessions over the last several months, most of the large studies suggest that churches have between 18 and 35% of their congregations made up of people over the age of 65. Now that varies a great deal by denomination, a great deal by where they're located. But an interesting thing that I had forgotten, but in looking at my notes for today, I was reminded, but we had a couple of people give us examples of how even things like visiting people in their homes was becoming more difficult because single pastors in large congregations just didn't have the kind of help and support that they needed. And one of the research articles that I came across last spring suggested precisely that it was smaller congregations with fewer clergy who have the highest percentages of older people. And I think anecdotally that was confirmed by two or three of the examples that were given yesterday. So I think the other part of this argument and the reason I want to bring up some of the issues I want to touch upon today is that if we become convinced that focusing on the older segment of our population is an important ministry for our churches, that it's something that certainly needs to be done with pastoral staff, but that it's going to take a real commitment by congregations and people in the church. And I'm going to try and provide some examples of how that can happen. I'd like to just go down this list quickly and then see if we have any that we might want to add to it and then segue into what's going on in some of your churches. And then I'd like to give some specific examples of things that I think we could be doing based on what we know about research on aging and the ways that we can improve people's quality of life. Dr. Koenig talked about the need to have meaning, purpose, and hope. He talked about support in dealing with loss, and one of the things that we talked about a little bit yesterday is that we need to think about loss as being a rather broadly defined issue. For example, for many older people, the loss is not associated with death and dying or those sorts of things, but is associated with things like not being able to drive anymore. It's associated with things like not being able to carry on the kind of life that they have always had, and that represents itself as a loss. And so that's an area that I think we could all become more cognizant of. In some ways, this is his list, so I mean, if we were to choose to do this, we could probably combine some of these. In some ways, continuity is the same sort of, is the flip side of that coin, that what people really would like to do is be able to have continuity throughout their lives. If they've always lived in their home and they want to keep living in their home, to be able to maintain that continuity is a very important thing. And here's where I think staying in close contact and providing information and working with families can be very important. I used yesterday the example of my wife's grandmother, who's now 80 years old, and her son, who lives many hundreds of miles away last year, just one day said, "Mom, you need to stop driving." Well, there really wasn't, she happens to live near us, there really wasn't a lot of empirical evidence upon which he was basing that. He probably just decided she's 80 now, she's having trouble concentrating for long periods of time, maybe she wouldn't drive. Well, the fact of the matter is she only drove a mile north to the grocery store and a mile south to the post office. And if she was going anywhere farther, she didn't need to go anywhere. For her, that has been a tremendous loss. It's sort of humorous anecdote tied to it is that in order to try and maintain some of her independence, within weeks she went out and bought a three-wheel bicycle, which is really a good thing, gets her a lot of exercise. The unfortunate thing about it is the main road that she drives to these two places, the grocery store and the post office, don't have sidewalks. And so she's riding this three-wheeled bicycle on the side of these four-lane roads. She's much more likely to die or be injured on this darn bicycle than she would be in the car. But loss can come in a lot of different ways. And I think we need to recognize that people want to maintain continuity in their lives. Dr. Koenig argues that it's important to engage in religious behaviors and, related to that, receive validation and support for maintaining those religious behaviors, attending church, praying, being a part of Bible study groups, and that sort of thing. Number six, maintaining personal dignity and a sense of worthiness. I think that's something that's of great concern to a lot of people. There's good evidence, for example, that I've made the comment previously this week that when we talk about shut-ins and people that we need to go visit in their home because they are unable to come to church anymore, that they're not shut-ins or we don't go visit them because they're old, but because there's something specific that they're struggling with. For example, one in three women over the age of 55 suffers from urinary incontinence. And for many people, that's a reason to not want to be social, to not want to be around other people. And yet that is a specific medical condition that we can now remediate in ways that are non-invasive, non-surgical, and actually some things that could be taught by you or I to people in ways that would improve the condition such that they would be comfortable, again, being social in the way that they have always been social. He says that they have a need to be loved, express anger and doubt, rely on God, love and serve others. And I think that's a big one, actually. Even in research that has nothing to do with religion, spirituality, or anything like that, having, even after you control for level of impairment, age, family members available, all of those sorts of things, even severely impaired or frail people, if they're able to be an active participant in helping someone, in contributing to someone else's life, it has an impact on improving their quality of life, whether you measure that as just their psychological well-being or their personal assessment of their health. So having a sense
love and serve
others. But that serve others, I think, is an extremely important part of that.
There's a second part to that, too. I'm a doctor that deals with a number of older folks.
Oh, terrific.
Case in point, a woman in her mid to late 70s whose husband died of cancer. Financially well off, no problems there. But just lost. So why don't you go volunteer at the hospital? I said, well, look, I almost took her by the hand across the street. Said, hey, talk to these people. They'll find something for you to do, you know. So she, you know, tinkers around in the coffee shop. She takes flowers to people's rooms and that kind of thing. And I've done that three times, three different people. And it gets their, you know, their mind off worrying about things, for one thing. They're not so concerned about what really are trivial problems. They start focusing on helping other people, and, you know, literally come back and said, that's the best thing that's ever happened to me.
Wow. Well, it's I'm thrilled you're here because some of the specific examples I think you'll have a lot of input on, some of the things we've learned in the last 10 years of research, now that the government and others are putting more money into understanding healthy aging, I think is part of the focus rather than on problematizing the issue. But I heard someone say in this sort of a similar sort of context, but that so much, especially in the United States, but I think it probably applies in many places around the world, that we see ourselves as, the phrase that was used was human doings, not human beings. And so much of what we are is associated with what we do, and having the opportunity to serve others as something that we do is very important, and that you do that sort of thing, it clearly has an impact on those individuals, and the research literature would certainly support that time and time and time again. A need to be thankful, and then to prepare for death and dying. And I think prepare for death and dying, as a couple of the examples I will use, is really needs to be viewed as a broad-based thing, not solely psychological or spiritual preparation, but that there are these days all kinds of other preparations that people are concerned about. We've had people in these sessions talk about purchasing long-term care insurance and all of those sorts of things as a way for them to take a look at their circumstances and the context in which they are aging and try and make good choices about how they will age and the kind of impact that they will have on family members and others as they age. Are there some other needs of elders, particularly perhaps frail elders, that you might think to add to this list?
I was thinking, and it's probably covered in there somewhere, I don't even know if it needs to be written down, but just something about personal security.
Okay. Actually, that's an excellent one. It was brought up yesterday, and I work in downtown Detroit, where personal security has for many years been an important issue for many people, especially older people.
Part of that, too, is just day-to-day. If you have a frail old person living alone, mm-hmm. changing a light bulb can be a life-threatening experience.
Right.
Quite literally. I mean, there has to be some way of dealing with the drippy faucets, the burnout light bulbs, the blown fuses, the lawn, screen door that's got a broken hinge, whatever. These people can't do it.
So I'm almost like minor home repair kinds of.
Well, yeah, just
minor upkeep home repair.
Kind of like day-to-day needs.
Yeah, groceries. I mean,
Okay.
Well, even if you could, they're so lonely, spend time with them, or if they're able to play games, play cards or dominoes or something with them, if their mind's alert enough to do that.
Mm-hmm. Great. Maybe we can add to this list as we go on. Let me, for just a moment, take a break, since some of you haven't been in these sessions before, to let you know what's available at the bookstore. If you have not read this book before, and some of you may have, but there's a paperback version of this book. It's called Having Our Say by the Delaney Sisters. Mm-hmm. Really, you may have heard them on the radio or the television. This was published 3 years ago. Since that time, they've come out with a second book called A Book of Wisdom, of which, if we have time at the end, I'll read a little snippet from. At the time of this writing, they were 103 and 101, parents born into slavery, never married, professionals, dentist and a teacher. But it's really, not only is it delightful reading, but it's a perspective on aging and on life that I think is interesting to read about, since in many ways it's different from the one you and I perhaps have experienced. So I would certainly recommend that as something that is interesting to read, and I think you'll find useful. In terms of something that's a little more information-based, it's different from Aging and God, but really what's been underlying my discussion in these sessions this week is my belief that aging related issues, because of the dramatic growth in the older population and where that growth is occurring. A couple of days ago we pointed out that while the older population will double in the next 50 years, the 85 and older population, which is where a great deal of our nursing home beds go to and a great deal of our resources for healthcare among older people goes to those 85 and older, that population will increase about 6 times in that same time period. So we really have a context where I think most people would look at the facts and say there's no way that we can continue to do what we're doing. I pointed out on Tuesday that currently we spend about 30% of our federal budget on benefits to the elderly in some form, and most of us would agree that that's a very appropriate thing to do. But the economic projections suggest that if we don't change the parameters of the programs that now provide those benefits, that over the next 30 or 40 years, we'll be spending 60% of our federal budget on benefits to older people. And I think most would argue that we aren't going to have 60% of our budget, federal budget anyway, to spend in that way. So this book by Ken Dykewall came out a few years ago. It's rather easy reading, but what he talks about is the impact of what he views, and I wouldn't disagree, as the most important trend of our time and how it will change all of our future, not just those who are older now, but those who are experiencing sort of the ramifications and the issues associated with aging. So I would certainly suggest that you pick that up as well. There are also, one of the things I wanted to accomplish this week was to make you aware of other kinds of resources that are available. You may be familiar with these, but the National Institutes of Health started about 5 years ago pulling together expert panels on various medical problems, not all of which are elder-specific problems, but many of which are. And I had sent here several copies, and they're in the bookstore. I have copies of 3 of them here that you will, you're perfectly, you may come and get, or they're in a basket by the books in the bookstore. But these are called clinical practice guidelines, and what they are, for example, on urinary incontinence in adults, is they got an expert panel together for about a year, and they spent a great deal of time going through the research and information that has been gathered over the last several years with respect to urinary incontinence. The focus is mostly on women, but certainly it's an issue for men as well, just the prevalence is much less among men. And what this is something that you or I or your physician or your nurse practitioner could use to be up to date on what are best practices, at least from the point of view of people nationally who are doing these sorts of things. Also have one on benign prosthetic hyperplasia, cataracts in adults, and I think the fourth one that I don't, somebody took my copy yesterday, but there are copies, is on depression in primary care for older adults. So these are here for the taking. There's also a book up there put out by the AARP on aging and its implications for a lot of things, including the environment, which is an interesting notion, and it spends some time discussing if we have this growing older population and we don't have the money to do things the way we have been doing them, and we're forced to use greater technology or other sorts of things to solve the problems, what kind of impact will that have on our environment? So I would encourage you to pick those books up.
That book, at least the red one, mm-hmm. That seems to come, and they probably all do, in 3 different levels.
Yes,
that's
good point.
That's the doctor's handbook.
Yes.
I was having great difficulty in trying to get past the third page.
Gotcha. I'm glad you brought that up. There is, in the back of each of these books, and if you want to just take the 800 number, there is an 800 number where all of these come from, and there are 16 or 18 of them, or I'd be happy to give you one of my cards and I can send you the list. I have the list at my office, so you can get them, but your point is very well taken. I'm glad that you mentioned that. They actually have 3 kinds, they have distilled this information in 3 forms. This is the clinical practice guideline book that, as you say, is primarily targeted for physicians or researchers or nurses, people who are doing these sorts of things every day. They also have what they call a quick reference guide for clinicians, although my recollection of it with respect to the incontinence book is that it was quite easy reading. So while it says quick reference guide for clinicians, that it was something that most of us would find fairly understandable. And then they have specifically have a consumer version, which would be very useful. My recollection is, again, in the context of the incontinence forms, is that it had much, much less information. So that it, while it might be a good place to start, it won't be too long before you're going to want to go to the quick reference guide or eventually to this book, at least to open up some specific pieces of information. But feel free to take a book if you want it just to know where to make the phone call to get these books. It says in the back that these are available for sale. My recollection in looking at the list was that 80% of these are available for free. And the four of these that I have, I obtained, I think I had 20 copies apiece sent here, and they were all free. So please use these in any way that you find useful. Let me move to, I wanted to use today to provide some practical suggestions as to things that we might think about doing in ministry, in our churches, and I hope that you'll add to some of these, because I'm certainly not a clinician who is on the clinical side of some of these issues. But over the last several years, there have been millions and millions and millions of dollars, gratefully, spent by the federal government and now many foundations on trying to address issues of aging. And fortunately for us, no longer approaching it just from the point of view of the problem of aging, which is, if you paid attention to many of these issues, say 10 years ago, virtually everything was characterized as aging. This is a problem of aging. Now we're much more in an orientation of realizing that what we need to be talking about is healthy aging, that in fact 2/3 of people over the age of 65 are perfectly healthy. They might have minor aches and pains or something like that. They might take a few more prescriptions than they once did, but they're perfectly healthy, and that we need to understand that and think about ways that we can maintain that functioning and that level of health. And this sort of is I think useful for us in the context of ministry in the church. One individual has suggested that typically the role of the church in aging is in four areas of sort of declining presence. One is religious programs for older people, Bible studies targeted to older people, those sorts of things. The second is pastoral care, visiting in homes or nursing homes. The third is, which is certainly very useful, is the church's host, and that is the church using its facilities to provide lunchtime meals or an aerobic program or something like that. And really the fourth, unfortunately, is characterized by this individual, is the church's service provider. And I think that's really where my argument would be that we could do a lot of improving, and that we could try and overcome some of people's concerns about what might be involved in doing these kinds of things. So what I'd like to do is try and throw out some ideas for you of what we might do, and ask you to amend them, argue against them, suggest that maybe there are better ways to accomplish the same sorts of things. Let me start with one example. I am aware from my small sample of churches that I've attended over the last several years that hospital visiting remains something that you don't always have people jumping out of their seat wanting to do. They find it onerous, they don't like to go to hospitals. It has been my observation that part of that, however, is people aren't at all sure what to do once they get there. And what, in effect, we tell them to do is, well, you know, we can pray with them and we can assure them that things will be fine and all of that. I would say that in an aging context, actually, we could take something like hospital visitation and put a different light on it for this reason. We know two things in the last 10 years or so that are very important. One is that touch has a healing effect on people. We know that from actually a quite large literature now on children. If you look at children and have a group that is held regularly in a pediatric intensive care unit, for example, and a group that isn't, the group that is held regularly will get healthy quicker and will get better quicker. There's also been some recent work in an aging context where just simply sitting with people and holding their hand or stroking their hair or something like that can have a very positive effect on them. So I think one of the things that we can begin to do on something that in an area in which we've been doing hospital visitations a very long time is to communicate to people that there are things that we can do while we're there that have real important outcomes for people. A second thing that actually is quite rather new research is that there has always been some frustration among the part of many physicians and nurses that deal with have many older people in their patient population that when they have an acute condition and enter a hospital, they're there to help and they're there for several days, but when they come out they may not have the mobility or the flexibility or the capability to function that they did before they went in. And there's been some research lately looking at large hospital populations that suggests, in fact, especially among older populations, if they're in for several days, that there's a bit of, I'm not sure exactly what all the physiological responses are, but there's some muscle atrophying that takes place because they're mostly laying in bed for that entire period of time. So there have been some intervention studies very, very recently that suggest that if you do some very simple things that would be along the lines of physical therapy, but something that you or I could do very easily, that would be a very positive, have a very positive impact on older individuals who are in hospitals. I don't know if you've had any experience with these sorts of things or not.
Not formally.
Okay. But the literature that I've seen, and again, this is a very recent sort of thing, is that if you take a population pool, a patient population pool of older individuals, and for half of them, you spend even a half an hour a couple of times a day, but anything would be useful, getting them to move their limbs, better yet, even getting up and walking with them down the hallway, that they will be much more mobile, in much better shape functionally when they get out than people just like them who don't have that kind of intervention. So I would argue these are some of the things that we could be into the doing sort of end of something like hospital visitation. Another thing that came up yesterday that, and if you would like, I brought several copies of a book chapter with some examples that you may take with you. But we talked a little bit yesterday about that what is often done for older people in our congregations is mowing their lawn, is sometimes painting their house and those sorts of things. But the comment was made that even among youth groups, that there would probably be some great interest in doing more, in doing something that they felt was going to have a long-term dramatic effect on people's lives. I think one of those areas would be in terms of the in-home environment of an older person. One of the things we know about older populations is that falling is a tremendous problem and can have tremendous effects on people, often putting them in the hospital or a nursing home or something like that. And there's now been a great deal of research to suggest that we can do some fairly simple in-home interventions that will decrease the likelihood that people will fall. And it gets back to the comment that was made earlier about upkeep and daily needs. While I don't have one of the lists in front of me, we know, for example, that you need to get rid of any throw rug. We know, and I'll go through my list and you might add some to them. We know that there need to be grab bars around toilets and tubs. We know that the maximum wattage permitted in lamps and light fixtures needs to be in place, which is often not the case in any of our homes, to say nothing about an older person's home. It is possible and reasonable to slightly rearrange the furniture in such a way that someone could mobilize across any room in their home such that they wouldn't be taking more than a step or two without having something to lean on or attach themselves to. I don't know what other kinds of things you might add to that sort of a list.
Make sure there's a telephone reachable from the floor.
Good point.
I'm a nurse and I've done a lot of work with elderly people, a lot of teaching too. Mm-hmm. And another one is to have a nightlight on at night. So when you get up, an elderly person does not get up into a dark room trying to get to a bathroom, put on a bright light. And actually the danger is when you go back, because they come out of the bright lights in the bathroom into the dark bedroom. And an older person takes very much longer to accommodate to that than we do.
Very good point. And these are things where I don't know, I don't remember the exact statistics on falls, but I think in any geriatric population, falling is a critical concern. Is it something you talk to people about frequently?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's one of the biggest problems. Falling, not being able to get up off the floor because of weakness, fractured hips, and somebody that's over 80 is something like 30% mortality. Mm-hmm. I mean, not necessarily from the hip fracture, but from the complications of pneumonia and bed sores and, you know, all kinds of problems that are attendant to that. Another thing, people will, older folk will shuffle around in loose slippers.
Uh-huh. You know, good point.
Get tangled up in things. Carpet versus vinyl floor, you know, that between the kitchen and the living room or dining room or whatever it is, often get hung up there and take a tumble. It does make a lot of sense to go through somebody's house and, you know, make sure that throw rugs, kitchen, you know, in front of the kitchen sink, people will put down rugs to catch any drips and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Those are really hazardous.
Yes, they are.
Can't get their feet up.
They are. And this is the sort of thing that you know, I think certainly applies to us as individuals, but most of the checklists that I have seen where you can go through someone's home with the materials at the ready, and we're not talking about materials that cost a great deal of money. In fact, it's fairly common for firms, if a nonprofit group or a church were doing this sort of thing, to even contribute at cost or something, things that would otherwise be somewhat expensive, like grab bars or something like that. But most of it is fairly simple. It's either completely inexpensive, completely no cost, or it's very inexpensive in the form of higher wattage light bulbs and things like that. And I think that's, vis-a-vis our a couple of the comments that were made yesterday, I think that's the kind of intervention that even a high school youth group could receive some training with supervision and have the opportunity to go into people's home and provide that kind of service that they would view as something that would be very positive and would teach them a great deal about a group of people that, as we've talked about in previous sessions, many kids these days don't come in contact with people. I mean, my kids don't come in contact with people over 40 very often. We're fortunate to have this great-grandmother nearby, but other than that, they don't see their grandparents but a couple of weeks a year and that sort of thing anymore.
There's another aspect of it, too, though, and that's getting the older people to accept.
Exactly.
My mother's very attached to her Lilleris. I mean, every time we go to visit her, he says, these are really dangerous. You really shouldn't have this.
Oh, throw rugs, then you're supposed to throw them away.
But I also work with, and we call it our care team ministry in churches, and it's called Second Family. Hmm. And we have teams that go out and actually do what we're talking about.
Oh, terrific.
But getting some of the elderly to accept help is another aspect of this that we don't think about. It's
That's
easy
right.
for us to sit here and say all the things we can do.
Right.
But
But this then moves back to the other edge of the board where not if they still want to feel useful, they don't want to, you know, acknowledge that they need help.
I agree.
But not only that, but most of them don't want things changed.
That they're continuity.
Very,
yeah, yeah. It's the continuity. And that's where it may take some creativity in the form of even in a rather immediate sense, where they can give something back, whether it's a meal or whether it's...
Well, in some of the cases, we've had our care team members actually say, I need to be able to do this for you, you know, turn it around that I need you to let me come in and sit with you or do the things.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. A related thing that I wanted to make you aware of, and these are the book chapters that I have available if you'd like to take them with you, but there's been a tremendous amount of work, although in a rather short time frame, on ergonomics and design issues associated with older populations. So when you think about homes, for example, what are some of the most difficult things for older people to deal with that have arthritis or are not able to mobilize themselves or don't have the small motor dexterity that they once had?
Stairs.
Okay.
Taking tops off of medicine.
Okay, taking tops off of medicine.
And groceries, some jars you can't open.
Right.
I mean, you don't have to be that old not to be.
That's
okay,
right.
Take
yeah.
a 4-year-old alone.
There you go. Well, there are other sorts of things too, like for many door handles. Mm-hmm. Round door handles are a problem. As one of the examples in this book chapter points out, thermostats are very difficult for many people who have small motor problems or arthritis to deal with. I know the one on my home is a little teeny tiny dial that I've got to get my fingernail in there to get it to move right. And one of the things that we need to be aware of in this context is that a great deal of work has been done on providing design items to assist in these areas. So for example, there are now products on the market that you can put a lever door handle mechanism right over a round doorknob. So it's a plastic, it's a rubber element that you slip, someone has to do it for them. But once it's there, then the door is a lever that more people can operate than they can a doorknob. There are attachments now for thermostats that instead of the little teeny tiny dials, you have an inch wide ridge mechanism that surrounds it, that you can do this to it. And so there are all kinds of new design opportunities available. One of the things that I always find curious is that we're so far behind in this issue. Even in I live in Detroit, so automobiles are something I've learned a great deal about. Even things like automobile seating, where automobile companies still use Navy jet pilots from the 1950s as their source of data for figuring out how to design car seats that will be comfortable for people. And when you think that in something expensive and many in quantity that are produced every year, that we're still that far behind in design, on one hand, it's no wonder that we've just started to think about an older population in this regard. But we have started, and there are many good examples in this book chapter, and even some firms that if you're interested in these sorts of things, but there are corner seats that you can put in bathrooms. There are tub inserts for people that are unable to get themselves all the way into a tub that they can shower or bathe themselves still in their tub. There are canes now that, first of all, have better ergonomically designed handles for people, but double as a reacher and a grabber so that people can reach out and don't have to bend down. And there's examples of those sorts of things. The thermostat example here, scissors now that are more like grass clippers than they are like scissors so that they're easier for people to operate. So there are many, many design kinds of things that we can let people know about, and these would be some of the examples. Another opportunity, and you may have some experience with this as well, but there's been a lot of research published actually in the New England Journal of Medicine and the Journal of the American Medical Association in the last couple of years suggesting that while aerobic exercise for older people, walking or low-impact aerobics or something like that, is can be very useful, that also a form of weightlifting can also have a dramatic impact on people. One of the first studies that was done was actually done in a nursing home with people in their 80s and 90s, and they found that they were able to dramatically increase the functioning and the strength and the mobility of individuals in the nursing home by enrolling them in a 3 times a week for 15 or 20 minutes a day weightlifting program. And they had 80 and 90 year old women that were lifting 50 or 60 pounds where they started out with 10. And I think those are the kinds of creative kinds of things that we might want to consider as well, because that can be done relatively inexpensively. It can be done using church facilities, or it can be done by us going out into nursing homes or community centers to do these sorts of things. Are there other kinds of relatively new interventions that you're aware of that are designed to increase mobility and functioning?
Well, a lot of assistive devices, walkers and four-point canes and those sorts of things. I think the biggest problem I see relates to what you're talking about with muscle weakness. We have older people whose vision isn't as good as it was,
right,
whose nervous system isn't what it was at one time. They have trouble perhaps with balance. You add a little bit of arthritis to that. It hurts them to get up and around. They're unsure of themselves, so they don't.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the more they sit, the weaker they get.
Exactly.
And after a while, it's extremely difficult to do just the daily routine, if you will. A lot of these people do much better if we get them into physical therapy for a while. But again, that's something that you have to continually keep at. I mean,
right,
you don't use it, you lose it.
Right.
It holds every bit as much for somebody that's 80 as somebody that's 20. I mean, we don't have to make Arnold Schwarzenegger cut all of our geriatric population, but they do need the muscle strength to get up, you know, out of chairs, off the toilet, out of bathtubs, out of bed.
Right.
And
I think we used to, the research on this issue is quite new. I think in part we used to think that the muscles couldn't be regenerated as quickly as they can. I think that's the exciting part of some of this research, is that they're finding that among even the very old and frail, that dramatic changes can occur.
I work with 80 and 90 year olds doing yoga,
oh, yeah?
Tai Chi, and different types of exercise every day.
Really?
And we have some who absolutely will not miss.
That's terrific.
Yeah, you know, and the changes are real obvious.
Yeah.
Is this where they have to go out of their home to do it, or?
I work in a nursing home.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Another aspect to many of these sorts of things, especially those that are daily or at least frequently throughout a week, is we've talked in earlier sessions about even fairly simple things like having a mechanism whereby you can check to make sure somebody is okay. And a lot of people, as has already been mentioned, maybe don't want to be checked up in that sense. On the other hand, to have them a part of a Tai Chi session, if somebody doesn't show up, somebody goes to find out what's happening. And I think even in a community setting that sort of thing can be accomplished very well. We know, for example, that after you control for health and level of functioning and those sorts of things, that living alone is one of the strongest predictors of being in a nursing home, because when the physician or the nurses or social worker or whoever is doing the assessment asks about living situations, if they believe that someone needs to be around regularly to check up on them, there might be the suggestion to move into a nursing home. So if we can provide those kinds of mechanisms, we might be able to forestall entry into a nursing home for some of those people. Let me just mention a couple of others, and then I want to refer to, it sounds like you have an excellent program going already, and I had come across one that I just thought the objectives that they laid out for this program when they developed it were quite good. Another area of recent interest has been providing opportunities for older people to review their life or do a life review or do writing associated with their life, both for their own purposes, but also as a way to express their life and their experiences to others, including kids, for example. A lot of that work is going on in nursing homes, actually.
Well, and in our care teams that are actually teams from different churches in our area, our nursing home is the education center for the care teams in the churches.
Mm-hmm.
But we talk to them about just listening.
Great.
Just letting the people talk. And also, like, we have one Lou Gehrig's person who is now telling her life story to one of the care team members, and she's putting it on her computer. And
oh, that's terrific.
You know, a really neat gift.
Yeah, it is. I actually, one of the faculty that works for me at my university runs writing groups in nursing homes, and some of the nursing homes she goes to, virtually everyone has significant cognitive deficits, and there is anecdotally the sense among the staff that just the act of participating, whether or not an hour later they remember what they said or what they communicated, but the act of participating and producing a piece of writing that is then read to the group and that everyone can respond to is a very, very positive thing. Yeah?
I've also read quite a bit about bed therapy, where they said if an old person has a bed, they live longer. Pet
therapy, yes.
Like a cat, dog, hamster, whatever.
I have heard that too, although, to be quite honest, I don't know a great deal about that. I don't know.
There has been quite a lot of research on it, and a lot of, certainly in California, a lot of nursing homes do have pet therapy programs,
mm-hmm.
which often through the local humane society, so that the people who bring the animals in are the owners. But animal and owner have been trained,
mm-hmm.
you know, what to do. But people who have not responded often respond to an animal because the animal is non-threatening.
Sure, and sure.
Also children. One of the places that I go to has quite small, I'm a long-term care ombudsman now, and one of the facilities I visit has quite young children acting as volunteers.
Hmm.
And they have sparked responses in some of the residents who had been refusing to go out of their rooms, but with the children, they were
That's
moving.
Great. That's great.
Yeah, I was just going to say on the dog, which is great if somebody else owns the dog, but I remember a matter of quite a few years back where I had a older friend who was not in too good health, so somebody decided she needed company and they gave her a dog. Well, somebody else had to take the dog from her because she didn't have the slightest idea of how to take care of that dog thing that could become a burden to
I think one other thing that has come up in our previous sessions that churches could productively do is become a source of information, not only for older people, but for family members of older people struggling with these issues. A couple of people that were here yesterday were saying that, you know, their congregations were relatively young congregations, did not have a lot of older people. And my response was along the lines of, it wouldn't surprise me for a moment if they were to survey their church membership, if there weren't a significant number of those people who were struggling with some of these sorts of needs among family members, some of whom may be quite a distance away. And I think having some sort of an information resource or referral center tied to nursing homes, tied to, I've mentioned in every session, the Area Agency on Aging that exists in any area that we live in the country and needs to be used as a resource. And I think those are the kinds of things. One other thing that I came across, and it sounds like you have a similar sort of thing, I'd love to learn more about it, but there was an article about what was called a life care ministry program begun by St. John's Lutheran Church in Stamford, Connecticut about a decade ago, and I just thought I would read for you the five objectives that they had when they started this program. I think I should also tell you that someone had given them a lot of money, so they this was the choice they made in how to use the interest from that money to develop a life care ministry. But here were their objectives. Establish a senior citizen group with church members, and that's something that has come up in previous discussions. Investigate and utilize community resources and services. One of the things we know that about that for many older people, the issue is not that services aren't available, but that they either don't know about them, or that even if they know about them, they don't want to use them. But for a big part of that group, they don't even know that they exist. And I think that's where we could do a lot of have a lot of improvement. Their third objective was to conduct a public relations campaign within the congregation and the community, announcing the program, requesting ideas, and inviting referrals. The fourth objective was to recruit and train volunteers to assist in providing certain services. And it goes on to say that the services ranged from grief counseling to financial, to living wills, durable power of attorneys, all those sorts of things. And finally, to develop a program which addresses the concerns of the families of the elderly. And in fact, within their church offerings, they even made it a part of their Sunday school curriculum, that they would have some segments that would deal with issues of aging and have older people come into the kids' Sunday school rooms so that they could develop those kinds of connections. So it would be, this sounded like a terrific program to me. It was something that they had a full-time staff person for, and maybe as we have, as parish nurses have begun to take hold in some places, we have a church right in a suburb right next to where I live that has it now as a full-time staff person, a nurse, that over time we will begin to think about perhaps having that nurse or even an additional staff person who would focus on issues associated with the older population, but also the families of those people who are struggling with a number of issues. I'd like to, we need to close, I'd like to, as a way to entice you to perhaps pick up the paper copy of this book that's available in the bookstore, just read you a very brief piece from their second book, the Delaney Sisters Book of Everyday Wisdom. And this is one of the sisters talking. Folks constantly ask about the secret that has kept us alive so long. At this writing, they were 105 and 103, I think. Well, that's something only the Lord can say. We try our best to preserve our health, and one way we do it is to watch what we eat and drink. We start our day by drinking a full glass of water, followed by a teaspoon of cod liver oil and a whole clove of garlic. A whole raw clove. That's right. Garlic is good for preventing colds, and it's good for your bowels. We chop the clove as finely as we can, then scoop it up with a spoon and swallow it all at once without chewing to prevent odor. We wash it down with one glass of cold water, then one glass of hot water. Then we fix our breakfast. In the past few years, we found that breakfast is our most important meal. It's our biggest meal of the day, and we eat it right after we do our exercises. We have a scrambled egg each, a hard roll, and fruit, along with a bowl of oatmeal. I mean home-cooked oatmeal. Not that instant stuff. We have a good meal at midday. Northern folks call that lunch. We southern gals call it dinner. We eat chicken or beef. Although we love fish, we don't eat it much today. We worry about its being contaminated. In the evening, we make ourselves a big vanilla milkshake. It's not good to eat your big meal toward the end of the day. Every day, we take vitamin supplements, vitamin A, B, complex, C, D, E, along with zinc and tyrosine. We vary the amount depending on how we've been feeling lately. For example, if I start to get a little tickle in my throat, like I'm going to get a cold, I take more vitamin C. Antioxidant vitamins are the best. We think it's best to get your vitamins naturally from food you eat, but supplements are a good idea. I keep saying we, but the truth is, Sadie's the one in charge of our health. She makes me take cod liver oil. I can't stand the nasty stuff, and eat what she tells me. If she doesn't think I'm eating enough, she watches me. That just ruins my appetite altogether. She drives me a little crazy, but I guess she's doing something right. I have 103 years of living to show for it. They really are cute, and I'd suggest you take a look if you're interested.
Do they live by themselves still?
They, as of this writing, they still live by themselves, although I had read one of the snippets on a previous day. They clearly do have a neighborhood situation and a social context in which people are stopping in daily. But the thing I read earlier talked about them watching some of the neighborhoods for an hour or two in the afternoon. So there are clearly many mechanisms where people are watching them and aware of them and how they're doing each day.
So. There's a book, and I wish I could remember the name of it. It's Something Champions, and it's about, each chapter is a vignette about a person who in the second half of their life changed their lifestyle dramatically, and these are people who have run into late life. Somebody in his 90s who water skis regularly.
I have heard about that book.
It is absolutely wonderful because it just, when you start talking about healthy aging, because people do tend to think of the aged as the people in nursing homes.
Absolutely.
And this shows a dramatic other side to it.
And I think I've heard of that and not seen it. I would love to. But I think the point you made is right on target, that we need to disabuse people of the notion that there's something bad about aging. There's a lot extremely wonderful about aging. Even the numbers that we talked about in previous sessions, I mean, most people of my generation are going to have 15 to 20 extremely healthy years even after they reach age 65. And so that's something wonderful to be looked forward to. And anything that we can do to maintain the healthy part of that healthy aging equation, I think it would be all in our benefits to do. And again, my argument would be that as churches and as Christian people, we can play a role in doing that, and that we're going to need to play a role because the public policy changes that will be occurring as we speak are going to mean less services, less of the kinds of things, very kinds of things that may be most useful for people.